From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The next White House administration could have its first African-American attorney general. And with a win in Alaska, one that took 2 weeks to confirm, the Democrats are closer to filibuster-proof control of the U.S. Senate. Here to talk politics, we've got Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Ron Christie, the CEO of Christie Strategies. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, guys.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
So, reports say that the president-elect Barack Obama has offered Eric Holder the job as attorney general. He's expected to accept. He was the deputy AG in the Clinton administration. He's African-American. And I spoke to him before the election about challenges that the Justice Department is going to face in the next administration.
And then when you look at the other issues that I think the next president is going to have to deal with, chief among them is going to be trying to revitalize and remake a Justice Department that has been really sullied in the last 4-8 years or so by people who tried to politicize it. And I want to make very clear, I am excluding the present attorney general, who I think is doing a good job, and as well as the people who served as deputy attorney general, who I think have done a good job.
You know, Donna, when you think about the narrative of the Obama administration, there's definitely been one where it's about, revitalizing America's place in the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see from Holder coming up if he takes this position?
First of all, I think Eric Holder would make an incredible attorney general. I've known Eric for many, many years. In fact, I worked with Eleanor Holmes Norton, the congresswoman from the District of Columbia, who recommended Eric Holder as the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. He is by far an exceptional lawyer. He knows the Justice Department, having served there during the Clinton administration. I think he will bring a great deal of credibility in not only restructuring that department so that it can handle some of the most important cases going forward, whether it's national security, the prisoner status at Guantanamo Bay and what we do with that facility, as well as making sure that our nation gets back to equal protection under the law. So I would endorse this announcement once it's made by the president-elect.
Ron, when you think about this man who is, possibly poised to be incredibly powerful, there is this question of his involvement with former President Clinton's pardon of the fugitive financier Mark Rich. Do you think that an issue like that could hold up his appointment, or is that too insider?
I think it could be too inside baseball. I mean, certainly I have a number of concerns about the then Deputy Attorney General Holder's role in the pardoning issue. I think the Clinton administration bungled that, to say it very politely. I think that they issued pardons in one of the most egregious manners possible. But that being said, everything that I have known and heard about Eric Holder, and having worked with him briefly, and he even spoke at my law school graduation over 10 years ago, he's certainly a man of exceptional intellect. And one thing that struck me when he gave a speech at GW Law School 10 years ago was that he said that regardless of how successful the most African-American person is, when the day still comes that people cross the street when they're in neighborhoods, when they're looking at somebody based merely upon the color of their skin, they're going to look at you, they're going to look at that individual the same way. So we have to move beyond a system where people are judged fairly or unfairly based on the color of their skin, be they the most powerful and successful lawyer or the most young and struggling individual. And that's always struck me, and I thought that was a very profound statement that he made.
Donna, do you have any other thoughts on this cabinet? You know, there's been the talk of whether or not Senator Hillary Clinton could be the Secretary of State. There's reports that Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is going to become the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Any thoughts on how this cabinet is shaping up?
I think, first of all, the president-elect has announced some of his key White House advisors. Valerie Jarrett joined that rank as a senior advisor and assistant to the president for both public liaison and intergovernmental affairs. It looks like the administration is shaping up quite strongly. The president-elect has put together a strong policy team comprised of people from all walks of life. He will review and analyze some of the major initiatives that his new administration will face. But in terms of the cabinet position, because I think everybody loves the Washington, D.C. parlor game, he has an embarrassment of riches. As I look at some of the names that are still floating out there, you mentioned Tom Daschle. Of course, we've heard that Robert Gates might stay on at the Department of Defense. When you look at positions like HUD, another key office, given the foreclosure crisis, Jim Clyburn's name is out there. Shirley Franklin, the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, her name has been mentioned. Clearly, with regards to the Department of Labor, there are a number of key people who are under consideration, as well as the Department of Education. So I think it's coming along very well. But again, these are names that are being floated out there. President-elect Obama will likely not make any announcements until after Thanksgiving.
All right. I want to move ahead, Ron, with the question of filibuster-proof majorities. We're talking about the Senate. Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, who is a convicted felon at this point, just lost his seat to the Democrat Mark Begich. Two Senate races are still undecided. It's a very strange situation. But first of all, give us a brief taste of why 60 is a magic number in the Senate. And then, you know, do you think that the Democrats will grab that?
Well, the reason that 60 is a magic number in the United States Senate is that in order to cut off debate, there's a procedure known as a cloture vote. And what that really says in plain English is saying, stop talking, let's vote on an issue, let's move forward. And you need 60 votes to invoke cloture. So when you look at it from the other side, it's important for the minority, if they want to exercise any ability to control what goes on in the chamber, to at least have a number of votes, and of course the magic number is 40, so that you can interrupt a cloture vote, or you can say, look, you're going to have to deal with me, because if you don't, then you're going to be stuck in a situation where you can't pass anything. So 60 is the magic number. Looking at the Republican status right now, I think it was expected that Senator Stevens was going to go down. Seven-time indicted and now convicted felon, he needed to go one way or the other. But now you're looking at two crucial races, one in Minnesota where Norm Coleman is trying to hang on against the former Saturday Night Live comedian Al Franken, and of course in Georgia, Saxby Chambliss is the Republican incumbent. I don't think the Democrats are going to get that magic 60 number. I do think that we'll be able to hold on in Georgia, but at this point, Minnesota is just too close to call.
Donna, there's another issue that relates directly to this, and that is Senator Joseph Lieberman. He's keeping his chairmanship of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Now, this is the guy who was the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats in 2000, but this election around, he supported Senator McCain. He spoke at the Republican convention. He criticized Senator Obama several times, saying, for example, that Obama would meet with, quote, the leaders of the most vicious anti-American regimes on the planet. So why is he still kind of maybe not getting the warm hug, but at least the, you know, like the pat on the shoulder from the Democrats?
I don't think he's getting the pat anywhere. I think what the Democrats decided to do, and remember, this is politics. They decided that they wanted Joe Lieberman to remain in the caucus as my good friend noted, to try to achieve a filibuster-proof majority. Joe Lieberman has voted with the Democratic Party 90% of the time. Of course, he does not vote with the party on national security matters as well as Iraq. But I think the signal really came from President-elect Obama that the Democratic Party, the Democratic Congress, should not be about revenge or grudges, but to give Joe Lieberman a second chance. Now, look, we all want to agree on how we go about doing our political business, but when you see over two-thirds of the caucus voting in the affirmative to keep him not only in the caucus but also in that position, clearly Joe Lieberman went in there hat in hand, apologized, asked for forgiveness, and they decided to move forward, keeping him closer and not throwing him out of the caucus.
All right. Yet another leadership issue. I mean, this is a time when there's so much shifting sand. That's that the Congressional Black Caucus has elected U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California as its new chair. You also have Congressman James Clyburn reelected to his post of House Majority Whip. But Congresswoman Lee was the only congressperson to vote against military involvement in Iraq in 2001. And one of the things I wonder, Ron, is whether or not there will be a perception that the CBC is moving further to the left.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Congresswoman Barbara Lee represents a district right across the bay from where I'm from in Oakland, the former seat from Ron Dellums in Berkeley, California, which is long known for its peace activist roots. The question that I throw out there, and I'm sure my good friend Ms. Brazil is going to jump on me for this, is why do we have a Congressional Black Caucus now? You know, I think that this is a relic whose time has come and gone. We certainly now have a president-elect and a senator, or now Barack Obama, who is the first African-American who's elected to be the president of the United States. You have James Clyburn, who is a very senior leader in the House of Representatives as well, who's also African-American. There are issues that confront this country from economics to housing to a car crisis, but I don't see things as being inherently black issues or inherently white issues. I see them as being American issues.
I have to jump in because we're closing in on the end, and Donna, you know, just give me a little tiny bit of your response.
Well, first of all, Barbara Lee is a champion for justice and freedom, and, you know, she just led a successful passage of legislation to remove Nelson Mandela from the U.S. terrorist list. I'm honored that she is not only going to chair the caucus, but lead the caucus at a time when we are experiencing a moment of national crisis with the economy, as well as trying to get us out of two wars. Just because we elected a black president doesn't mean that racism is dead in America. It may be off the radar, but it is still alive and well.
But I just don't know what black issues are. I'll leave it with that. I agree with you, Donna, but what are black issues?
Well, I'll tell you what black issues is simple. It is the enforcement of our civil rights. It is ensuring that we keep expanding equal opportunity for all. And it is making sure that we live truly in the promised land that Dr. King foresaw for all of us.
Okay, guys. It's a lot to talk about. And that's a wrap for today. Thank you.
As always, bye.
We may not need more black leaders, but we need black people fighting for freedom and justice, my friend.
All right. That was Democratic strategist and nationally syndicated columnist Donna Brazile, plus Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. From T-shirts and bumper stickers to YouTube videos and chain emails, Obama mania has reached a fever pitch, and some people are over it. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he's keeping track of what you think. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, some folks are on Obama overload. What are they saying?
It has become a bit much at times, but a reader named Martin Winnick wrote in our blog, "Obama overload, not for at least another 8 years." Another guy named Bill M. wrote, "I'm tired of Obama walks on water coverage, but the more insightful stuff I really enjoy. I really like the coverage from News and Notes." Well, thanks, Bill. And Teresa Johnson wrote, "I, for the first time since Jimmy Carter was in office, have been excited. Before it has begun, I plan to keep informed."
Now, the reality is that we really have been all over politics. And Eric Holder, we just talked about on politics. What have we got up on the web about him?
Yeah, well, you spoke to him right before Election Day, and the main focus of the interview was whether or not the campaigns were going to have legal challenges prepared in the event of a contested vote. But you also spoke to him about priorities for the next attorney general. So here's part of that conversation.
What role should the attorney general play in unraveling what happened during the financial crisis or the buildup to this financial crisis?
Well, I think some really intense, vigorous investigation needs to be done to see if any laws were broken. We're facing the greatest economic calamity since the Great Depression, and to the extent people have done anything, either by fraud, conspiracy, or broken any federal laws, I think that needs to be uncovered, and people need to be held accountable. And to the extent that people have profited illegally, they need to be found out, and they need to be prosecuted. And I think that should be a priority for the next attorney general.
So that full interview with Holder is on our blog, and he also talks about Guantanamo Bay and the future of the Justice Department.
We're also going to talk with someone who is a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll, or rather, we already spoke with Darius Rucker, who's formerly of Hootie and the Blowfish, and it was a really pretty interesting, I mean, just great, mellow conversation.
Right.
So how did we play with that online?
And a great performance, too. He performed three songs for us in our studio, and those clips are on our Facebook page, our YouTube page, and our blog, so people have no excuse not to see it. And we posted one clip a few weeks ago, and someone on our YouTube page wrote, "Awesome, simply awesome. I've loved Darius as a part of Hootie and the Blowfish, but I must admit that with country music, I think he's found his calling."
What else are we looking for from people?
Well, we're looking for people who have been recently laid off. We're looking for them to share their firsthand stories of how they're coping, how they're spending less money, and how they're looking for a new gig. So they can go to our blog, register, leave us a comment, and we'll get in touch with them about being on our show.
All right. Exciting stuff. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
We were talking to Jeffrey Bennett, the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from the studios of NPR West. High-profile African-Americans gather in New Orleans, and a new show delves into the lives of Atlanta's black elite. For some, it's not a pretty picture. We've got that and more on our Bloggers Roundtable with Mark Lamont Hill, a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com, plus The Root. Felicia Harvey is the editor of Black Politics on the Web, and pop culture critic Desmond Burton runs Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hey, how's
Hello.
It going?
Doing great. So let's start off with this conference. Hundreds of African Americans of prominence are meeting in New Orleans this week for the State of the Black World Conference. It's going to feature a who's who of Black America, elected officials, educators, hip-hop artists. Mark, what's your role?
You know, I'm going to be down there in the opening Indaba ceremony for new leaders, and so there'll be sort of new generation of Black leadership and activists, organizers, academics, and so forth. On panels, and I'll be on that opening panel, and I'll be on a few other panels on education and urban policy, and really just trying to take part in a really good conversation about how we can continue to move the Black agenda forward.
Now, the one blogger wrote us, the Black community will never let racism die. They'll ride that horse for all it's worth. They want to talk about being equal, but at every corner they have to bring up stuff like this. You know, do you think this is a situation? We just talked about this, actually, you know, today on the show. Very interesting comment from Ron Christie, who was like, why do we need all this Black stuff? Why does the Congressional Black Caucus still exist? I'm sure we're going to get some comments on that. But why do you think this conference is important?
Well, because irrespective of who's in the White House or who's in the Congress or who's on the Supreme Court, everyday Black people still experience, you know, lack of access to housing, health care, education. You know, there are still enormous disparities in everything from life expectancy to infant mortality. All of this, we pay more, we work harder for less money. You know, even if you control for class, we still have these extraordinary issues, you know, bearing upon our circumstance. And so we as a community have to come together and talk about these issues, not simply to blame the government or simply to talk about self-help exclusively, but to have a really nuanced and sophisticated conversation about how we can move an agenda forward. To talk about Black issues isn't to be divisive or to ignore the fact that these are quintessentially American problems, but it's to take responsibility for our community and to begin to move forward.
Now, Felicia, do you think that the best part of these conferences, if you support them at all, is what's said or the networking that goes on?
I would say probably a little bit of both, but to me, the value in these conferences is not really what's said or the networking. It's in the action that happens after the conference. And that's the one thing that I would want to stress about this conference. It's important to talk about solutions, but it's even more important to come out with an action plan of how do you put these solutions into action? And more importantly, how do you put these solutions into action at the local level? How do you actually implement the change that you've discussed?
Now, Desmond, do you think that these conferences can also be exclusionary? Because, you know, the reality is it costs money to try to get anywhere. If you're gathering people in one specific location, you're always going to force or ask some people to carry the freight. There's also the question of whether or not the invitations are inclusive or exclusive. Do you ever have a problem? And, you know, this is an issue that comes up with everything from the Black Journalist Conference to State of the Black Union. Do you ever have a problem with how conferences are structured in terms of who's in and who's out?
Well, to a certain degree, I think they are exclusionary. I think that exclusionary, if not economically, more so politically. I colloquially speak about this on AfroNerd, and I kind of call the State of the Black Union, which I think is probably the brother version of this, as the cornbread and greens affair that Tavis Smiley produces, because I say it jokingly,
wow.
But
oh boy,
but I know you'll probably get letters, but I mean this is what we're really dealing with. I remember when Mike Steele was on there and he had to apologize for being a conservative, and we just can't seem to have alternative speak during these kind of things. So I have a problem with just exclusive politically progressive voices on these things. I mean, let me just finish my point.
I thought you were done.
Are we going to see the same platitudes and protestations by Cornel West? Is he going to do, Dr. Dyson, he's going to do his same Jay-Z's version of 99 Problems? What are we going to really get out of these conferences?
Well, what are we going to get, Mark?
Well, I think one thing is, with regard to the first point, with regard to Tavis's conference, which is a little bit different, Republicans are invited all the time. Michael Steele got a warm reception at that event. And I think one of the reasons you don't see more diverse political representation is that many brothers on the right don't come to the event, or they decline the invitation. But at this event, I mean, you'll see a wide range of the political spectrum. You'll see far radical leftists. You'll see people who are moderates and centrists, the sort of Obama crowd. You'll also see black conservatives there. And what you'll see beyond the talk, and Michael Eric Dyson will be there, I hope. I'm sure he will be. Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, all these people will be here because they bring extraordinary insight into our issues and problems. But in addition to that, you'll also see grassroots activists trying to link these conversations to on-the-ground activism, not just sort of in talk, but in action the next day, the next week, and the next month. And I think that's one of the things you'll see is smaller sessions, which are devoted not just to talking, but to actually forming networks, to connecting the people, and to coming up with plans for the future. You can never solve local problems at a national conference, but what you can do is reignite the base, so to speak. You can lay out some issues. You can also form networks, and then you can hit the ground running when you get back home. I think we're going to do that this time.
All right. I just have to throw in to this, whatever your observations are about what you see on the ground, you say you can't solve local problems through a conference like this. But really, what people are dealing with now, although it starts at the top, it is very local. So I want to ask each of you to describe to me what you are seeing in your communities. Felicia, you're in Florida. What are you seeing in terms of the impact on the housing market, job market, even on your friends and family?
Well, everything's pretty much depressed, and it's causing people to be depressed. You see, the housing market is not—it's not that great, especially here in Florida, where you have this big housing bubble. Folks bought houses that cost a lot of money. The houses are not nearly worth what they were when they purchased them. The job market's not that great. People are losing jobs. People are losing their homes, and I guess there's kind of a general feeling of just unease. And I think right now, my family, my friends, people I speak to, they're just putting a lot of effort into making ends meet and trying to get by and remain optimistic that things are going to change. A lot of people were very excited about this election. A lot of folks got involved in manners and in ways that they hadn't been involved before. And right now, the hope is just that same energy and enthusiasm you used in this particular campaign cycle, you used locally to help advocate for those issues, to help make the economic situation here locally in Tampa and in the state of Florida more acceptable to everyone, to make everyone's reality a little better, just as a result of all the momentum that we've had as of late.
Desmond, what do you see going on? And, you know, is there any solutions-oriented work going on where you are?
I really don't think so. I mean, for what I see personally, I see home foreclosures. I know friends personally that are going through that kind of crisis. I see some degree of forced pragmatism on some people, but there are others that feel that things have always been the same thing, same way for black folks. So it depends on who you're talking to and what, what class level you're talking about. But for some black folks, it's the same, and for others, forced pragmatism.
Forced pragmatism, do you think it could be a good thing? I mean, sometimes people make better judgments when their backs are to the wall. Do you see any people around you, you know, sometimes when people have lots of money, they don't save. But then when they have a little money, they realize that maybe they do need a nest egg. And so there's this strange psychology. Have you seen people doing any of that?
Yes, I have. I mean, it puts you up against the wall. Definitely, there's certain things that you just cannot get away with anymore. I know, again, personally, with gas, even though gas is coming down to a certain degree, you know, I still look at the gas tank. I'm more cognizant of it. So I think that things are changing for the best as far as our mental attitudes. But there are still others who, I mean, even from a pop culture standpoint, I see hip hop still talking about Patron and that kind of thing. And I'm scratching my head and like, why are we still dancing with champagne and women's behinds are still bouncing and that kind of thing? Nothing is changing. For some people, things are changing. For others, it is not.
All right. Speaking of pop culture, perfect segue into the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Now, This is the third season. I have to admit, I was having a let's clean the house moment, and this is not my usual kind of thing, but I was just like, I think my jaw was on the floor, and I watched like four episodes during their marathon. And anyway, here's a little bit of the Real Housewives.
Anybody want a bitch tonight? We're going to start bidding on this bitch at $2.
If it doesn't make me money, I don't do it. I always knew I was destined for greatness.
I don't keep up with the Joneses. I am the Joneses.
In Atlanta, money and class do give you power.
People are intimidated by my success.
All right, it's attitude with a snarl. Mark, is this the kind of thing, you know, when you talk about going to a conference like yours, are people really looking up to folks like you who've got degrees, intellectualism, or do folks want to just really still be blingy? And what, you know, is this TV series influencing behavior, or I mean, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I'm catching up on the whole season right now. And as I've gone through it, I find it to be really fascinating. In some ways, it's not that different than a whole bunch of other stuff we watch. I'm a reality TV junkie, so I watch all the Flavor of Loves and the Rocks of Love and all these love shows and all this stuff. And they're all essentially the same to me. And they provide very dangerous representations of Black women, of gender relationships, of consumerism. And they do have a troubling impact, not just on adults, but on the young people who watch these things. So I think we need to challenge it all the way around. The other piece of this, though, I think, is the fact that much of the anxiety that you hear is a middle class or upper middle class anxiety about having their lifestyles being represented by these people at this time. In other words, a lot of the people I hear with outrage about Housewives of Atlanta don't have anything to say about Flavor of Love or some of the other sort of ignorant shows that come on TV. But now they're like, oh, my God, this isn't how rich people should be represented. This isn't how, you know, the black wealthy should be represented. And so their anxiety is more about having this sort of nouveau riche represent old money or take the place of old money in the public space rather than really having some trouble with the way black women or black people are represented on TV in a larger sense.
Felicia.
And the funny thing is, I think I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I hate reality television. I hate it. I refuse to watch it. I got conned into watching the Real Housewives of Atlanta marathon, and I did get hooked. And I was hooked because it was like watching a train wreck. It was horrible. And I think my problem with it, because you asked early on when we were leading into the segment, is it good for the race? Is it good for ratings? It's terrible for the race, mainly because we don't have the positive portrayals on television to balance all the ignorance of the Flavors of the Love and the Real Housewives of Atlanta. We don't have those positive representations as well to kind of balance that off. But now, is it good for ratings? Unfortunately, it is. And as long as people continue to watch these shows, they're going to continue to come on. So it's up to us to make positivity profitable. If we don't support and watch those shows that have positive portrayals or neutral portrayals of African Americans, then all we're going to get 20 years from now when Flavor of Love is on season 29, we're going to be complaining because that's the only thing that's on television.
All right. You get to round it out here, Desmond. Good for the race? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways?
Well, in some respects, I'm tired of this concept of black representation to begin with. I think I hate to be cautious of inferencing Obama in every second, but it seems foolish to constantly deal with this neo-minstrelsy, is what I call it. If anything, there should be a new revenue stream developed to show a different side of blackness. You have black rock artists, you have a black alternative hip hop artist. You have different
people doing
things.
And we'll be hearing later in the
things.
Show from Darius Rucker, who's now a country artist.
Exactly. Yeah. So we need to see more of these viewpoints of blackness, and to constantly go back to Burt Williams 2008. It's tired.
All right, great place to leave it. Thanks, guys.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good one.
You too. So we've been talking with Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. She was at member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Mark Lamont Hill, who teaches American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. He was at Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. And pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. He joined us from our studios in New York City. You can find links to their blogs and ours at NPR newsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Remember the days when TV's The Cosby Show was the ideal image of the black family? Well, step aside Cliff and Claire Huxtable. The Obamas are moving into the White House and taking the phrase, making it to a whole new level. Judge Lynn Toler writes about what she calls being an emotional genius, and part of that is picking role models. So do celebrities, politicians, and even fictional role models like the Huxtables really change us for the better? Judge Toler, let me turn to you. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the Obamas are preparing to move into the White House, and they've got those two adorable girls. And I have to admit, I'm smitten with those little kids. But how do you think they will be perceived as a role model for families?
I think, first of all, the times make the man, and what's going on colors the glasses through which you see them. Everybody's searching for a savior right now. I mean, things are very difficult economically. We've got two wars going on. So he's got some room to move. And I think short of, you know, dancing naked on the front of the lawn, everybody's going to look at him positively for a while because they're searching to be saved. Having said that, I think what the Obama presidency on a familial level and a cultural level, I think the best thing it does is it exposes them to the black middle class, not as and kind of leaves the secrecy. I mean, Claire and Cliff Huxtable, Bill Cosby got a little criticism because people said it was not an accurate reflection of black life, when in fact it is an accurate reflection of a section of black life. And I think we're going to be able to see more of it. It's going to be more upfront because Obama is a part of it, and he's unique in who he is and what he did. But the black middle class in that community is, I think, larger and more active than a lot of people understand.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one of the remarkable things about this situation is that the president-elect's mother-in-law is also planning on moving to D.C. to help raise the girls. And I don't think we've seen that kind of extended family interaction with the White House. I mean, what do you think that's going to do to people's perception of what a family is and what it works, how it works?
It is my hope that it will re-energize the concept of the extended family, because we as a mobile society have gotten away from that. But I think we will, especially as older people live longer and are better able to care for themselves and other as older age. My mother is, she doesn't listen, so I can say it. She's 78. And she is well equipped. When she comes to my house, she cleaned out the garage last time. Our society is changing. It is graying, and we've got to bring them back into our homes because, you know, it's part of what we have to do to accommodate the change in the demographic that we have. So that's a wonderful example.
All right. President-elect Obama has a 4-year goal for his girls. Here's what he told CBS's Steve Croft on 60 Minutes in the interview that aired on Sunday.
I know Michelle and I have talked about this a lot. How do we just maintain that precious normalcy in our two girls?
Yeah.
And, you know, because right now they're not self-conscious. They're, you know, they don't have an attitude. And I think one of our highest priorities over the next 4 years is retaining that.
I bet Grandma will have a little influence on that. But in general, you know, one of the things that I see is that people who are these high-profile families, like, for example, Will Smith and Jada, are, you know, when they have kids, they're kind of in this position where the kids are semi-private and semi-public. That must be a tough position. What do you think families can do if you know, they're even in leadership positions within people's communities? Like if you are a leader in your church, you might also have people looking at you and judging you. How can you deal with that?
I think the best way to deal with that is first of all, have the conversation about it with your children, how your situation is unique. But in that conversation, said you may be unique out in the world, but in this house, that bed needs to be made. I want your homework done. All of these basic conversations that I have with my children still need to be done. I know Denzel Washington said something really funny once about, you know, he was feeling the fumes of the rarefied air that he breathes. And he came home one day and his grandmother said, here, you know, here's a bucket, wash my windows. And it was sort of like you need someone to keep bringing you back to center so you don't fall off the cliff of all that attention.
Have you found in talking to all the people you've talked to and the different roles that you play that people really do pattern on media images, or do people just really pattern on their own families and friends?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that the media images are what people aspire to, and often wrongly, I believe. I, you know, to have a role model, I've never liked the concept of the role model because there's something wrong with everybody. I like the concept of selective theft. I steal a little bit from you because I like how you do this particular thing. I will steal a little bit from Michelle Obama because I like how she does this particular thing. Because there, you can't adopt someone's life as a whole because yours is so different and life is so intricate and odd and people do have failures. And you don't want to imitate that. You want to imitate that which is good. So you should, you know, selectively steal from those who are out in the world, but keep your role models or that concept more close to you because you really know those people, the ones that are at home, the grandmother, the mother, the aunt who's got it together. It has to be selective on both sides.
All right. Judge Toler, thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Country music has a shining new star. Darius Rucker is the former frontman for the 1990s pop group Hootie and the Blowfish. Now he's the first black artist to have a top 10 country hit since Charley Pride. His debut single, Don't Think I Don't Think About It, made it all the way to number one.
Saw you in the rearview standing, fading from my life. But I wasn't turning round. No, not this time. But don't think I don't think about it. Don't think I don't have regrets. Don't think it don't get to me. Between the work and the hurt and the whiskey, don't think I don't wonder about. Could've been, should've been all worked out. I know what I felt and I know what I said. But don't think I don't think about.
Darius Rucker has successfully crossed over from pop to country music with his chart-topping solo album, Learn to Live. Darius joins me now at our NPR West studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So it's so exciting to have you here at NPR West, and to have you, you're going to perform for us. So I'm very psyched about that.
Yeah, I'm glad to play. I love playing, and Glenn and I have been doing this a lot, so we're finally starting to get tight. So yeah, I'm excited to be here too.
So you've walked a lot of roads in music, and start me out on the first one. When did you first know that you wanted to be a musician?
Oh, when I was four. When I was four, all I would say was I was going to be a singer when I grew up. You know, I was going to be Al Green. That was it for me as a kid. I just wanted to be a singer. And, you know, I got a little older and you really, you know, realize you have to have a real job and all that stuff. So I went to school for broadcast journalism and just happened to meet the guys in my band in college.
Broadcast journalism, that's not a real job.
That's true.
But, yeah, so you met your band in college and you guys expected that you could make a living.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, you did better than that.
Yeah, all we wanted to do was make music as long as we wanted to. As long as we could be a band as long as we wanted to. And we signed the Atlantic and, you know, everything took off.
Only wanna be with you.
You know, we came out and everything went crazy and we had to sit back and just laugh, you know, and go, what's going on, man? We're just a bar band from South Carolina.
Sometimes I wonder if it will ever end. You get so mad at me when I go out with my friends. Sometimes you're crazy, then you wonder why. I'm such a baby, yeah, the dolphins make me cry. But there's nothing I can do. I only want to be with you.
Tell me about your roots in the South and how they influenced you musically.
Oh, big time. I grew up, you know, in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm 42 years old, so for me, a lot of what I remember back in the day was AM radio. And when I was a kid, you could hear Stevie Wonder and Buck Owens on the same channel. You know, and that was a thing for me, that just listening to AM radio and flipping through the channels and hearing these songs, that was where I really developed my love for music. That was where all the walls and lines between music were just taken down for me when I was a kid, because I just loved everything. I couldn't understand why everybody wouldn't listen to a country song. Everybody wasn't listening to, you know, a rock and roll song. I thought it was awesome.
Radio's gotten a lot more segregated since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's an understatement. I mean, today, everything's so specialty-oriented. It's one kind of music, and that's all you get to hear on the radio. And, you know, I liked it when I was a kid, and you could hear anybody on the radio station as long as it was a good song or a hit.
So you go, you're in Hootie and the Blowfish. You have any number of talents and interests musically. Learn to Live is doing so well commercially. Your R&B record did not find quite the same home. Why do you think that's the case?
I remember them playing my single, which I thought was just an R&B song, and somebody used the word alternative on R&B radio. And I think it was just a stigma of where I came from. It was R&B music. It's just that I came from Hootie and the Blowfish, and nobody wanted to hear that from me. And, you know, I was cool with that. I made the record I wanted to make, and I'm happy with it. But, you know, I don't think that record got – I think I got slept on a lot, but that's okay.
Well, let's talk about this record right now. All I Want.
Don't act surprised. It ain't like you didn't know. It's been a long, long time coming, and it's time for me to go. Trying to split things up could drive us crazy.
So where'd that song come from?
That song, Frank Rogers, who's my producer, and I, we got together. It was the first time we had met each other. We were talking about what kind of record I wanted to make. And I told him I really wanted to make a country record. And that was the first song we wrote together. You know, we are both really happily married guys. And you listen to that song, and it's a big divorce song. And people think the theme of country music, you know, my baby left me, my dog left me, and all that stuff. And so we just wanted to write a real basic country shuffle. And we came up with All I Want. I love that tune. I love playing it live. You know, and having Brad Paisley play it on the record was an amazing thing. And, I'm a big fan of that tune.
You, I understand, got a phone call from Maya Angelou. I don't know anything about it, but I was told to ask about it by my producer, Devin. So there must be something there. What's the story?
I was listening to, you know, Maya Angelou on the radio. She was talking about her love for country music. And one thing she had said that I was so, I agree with so much, is she said she was disappointed in how music is so segregated. Like, people will say without ever hearing a country song, I hate country music, and you've never heard a song.
I heard every word you said. I'm trying hard to understand exactly what it is you need from me. Baby, I apologize. I never meant to make you cry, but there ain't no doubt we can work it out.
I just sent a CD to her, and she loved it, and she called and wanted me to be on her show, and it was out of this world.
A lot of your life you've spent in front of audiences where there probably aren't that many black people.
Oh, yeah.
So what's that like?
It's something that I think I've kind of really gotten used to it over the years, but back when we really started taking off, it would be really strange to walk into a room of 20,000 people and you were the only African-American person in the room. I mean, that happened a lot. And it's one of the things where I really had to come to grips with it. I mean, I chose this life. I chose this job. This is what I wanted to do. And, you know, it's just not, you know, now it's just no big deal. It's just the way it is. I love my job, and I'm not going to change my job. So that just comes with the territory.
There's so many what I call racial sharing moments going on right now. And we, you know, we take them seriously, but we can also laugh at them. But sometimes, have you ever felt that people ask you to be their guide into some greater understanding of blackness?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been playing Hootie Blowfish for 23 years, and, you know, we've been doing it. And I think a lot of my friends used me as a vehicle to the experience. And I know a lot of people that probably when they met me were pretty racist people that are now really good friends of mine. And like a friend of mine, he was from King, North Carolina, and he grew up pretty racist, you know, and we started hanging out with me. We became good friends. And I remember 4 or 5 years ago, he goes home for Thanksgiving, and, you know, the star's at the table, and he gets up and walks out of the house. When things like that happen, I feel like that's a good thing, you know.
What do you love at this stage in your life about not music itself, but being a working musician, and what do you hate about it?
Oh, hate is the easier part. I hate being away from my kids and my family. That's really tough to be gone as much as I am. And I love to play live for people, and I love to see people, you know, enjoy themselves and enjoy music. And it's when it's my music, it's even better.
What do you think is going to happen to art as we go through these tough times?
Oh, I think art will survive. During these times, movies and music doesn't seem to suffer that much. Because, I mean, music gets you through all this stuff.
And where are you headed next? I mean, in terms of creatively, are you going to go back and make another country album? I mean, what do you think, besides touring, which I know you are.
Yeah, I'm going to tour, and then I'm gonna make country records back-to-back for a while until country radio doesn't want me anymore, or I got my own theater in Branson.
Oh, my goodness. Sounds like you got plenty of options.
Oh, it's going to be fun.
Darius, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was awesome.
Well, I can't wait to hear from you. You're going to play a little bit for us,
right? Absolutely. This is the new single off my record. It's called It Won't Be Like This For Long.
That was singer-songwriter and musician Darius Rucker. His new country album is Learn to Live. You can watch his in-studio performance at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.
He didn't have to wake up, even up all night, lying there in bed listening to his newborn baby cry. He makes a pot of coffee and splashes the water on his face. His wife gives him a kiss and says it's gonna be okay. It won't be like this for long. One day soon we'll look back laughing at the week we brought her home. This phase is gonna fly by, so baby, just hold on. It won't be like this for long.